Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the stabbing death of Ukrainian immigrant Irina Zarutska on a Blue Line train gets national attention with criticism and finger-pointing at a fever pitch. Meanwhile, the incident should or could threaten the future of public transit here, with Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy mentioning the loss of federal tax dollars.
Zero, none, nada.
This comes as voters go to the polls in the municipal off-year primary, for which turnout was higher than normal. And there were some upsets in that election we'll discuss. CMS had good news about test scores last week, but this week national scores showed troubling results for 12th grade reading and math, as well as 8th grade science. And Charlotte FC is set to make MLS history. They may achieve the longest winning streak ever. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News senior editor Eli Portillo. WFAE's education reporter James Farrell is also with us. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Good morning, everyone. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Morning.
Morning. So it took several weeks. It took several weeks, but the August 22nd stabbing death of Irina Zarutska on the Blue Line train in South End near the Camden Road stop got national attention this week. Donald Trump posted a video from the Oval Office on social media in which he took the opportunity once again to blame cities controlled by Democrats.
For far too long, Americans have been forced to put up with Democrat-run cities that set loose savage, bloodthirsty criminals to prey on innocent people. Really, very, very innocent people. In every place, they control radical left judges, politicians, and activists, and they've adopted a policy of catch and release for thugs and killers. In Charlotte, North Carolina, we saw the results of these policies when a 23-year-old woman who came here from Ukraine met her bloody end on a public train.
So this is getting national attention now, mostly from Republicans. It's also getting attention in Raleigh, which we'll talk about later. And not to minimize this tragedy in any way or any of these random acts of violence that seem to be endemic in this country, how has this particular instance seemed to have struck such a chord in people across the country? Eli.
Well, I think that the video, you know, you can't really overstate the impact that had. It was a completely brutal attack of the kind that we don't usually see in such graphic detail. Although, you know, just 2-3 days later after that video was released, we saw an extremely video of Charlie Kirk being killed. So we're kind of inundated in these right now. I think that that really hit a nerve. And then it also plays, you know, really right into the crackdown on cities trying to get, quote, law and order restored. It was amidst talk of sending the National Guard into places like Chicago and sending the Guard into D.C. So I think it was timing and a combination of how genuinely awful and shocking the crime was.
Yeah. In the immediate aftermath of this murder, some on Charlotte City Council were worried about the impact this might have on the transit tax referendum that voters will find on the November ballot. That also raised some hackles of some people. And this week on Fox News, U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, who is launching an investigation into CATS safety protocols, said the loss of federal funds for our transit system is a possibility.
If I find what I think I'm going to find, they are not going to have your federal tax dollars going to their public transportation system. Zero, none, nada.
He said, if I find what I think I'm going to find. Mary, what does he think he's going to find?
Yeah, so light on specifics so far. We've got a number of investigations going at this point. The FTA has said they're going to look into Charlotte's transit system, the North Carolina State Auditor's Office, and you know would expect that would look into their public safety contracts as well as things like financials, but certainly could be of great consequence for the system as it currently exists, as well as the transit tax referendum. Obviously, a big component of that plan is raising our county sales tax to raise money, but there's also a significant amount of federal money kind of preemptively baked into the plan. So to lose out on that would create a lot of headaches, to say the least.
Eli.
And I think it's ironic that just a few months ago, Charlotte leaders were really jazzed that Councilmember Tarek Bakary was going to be Sean Duffy's number two at the FTA. And there was a lot of hope and expectation that that would help get those federal dollars flowing by having a hometown booster as the number two in that spot. And now Sean Duffy's threatening to pull all the federal money, and Tarek Bakary is out of his job after about 5 months. So it's a really big reversal from where we
Yeah.
were in April.
Sidebar for just a moment. Tarek Bakary was in that job for 20 minutes. What happened? Do we know?
We have not heard. He said in a social media post that he'd accomplished a lot and he was ready to come home. That's a pretty quick tenure. And the federal government has just said he's no longer with the FTA.
So, in a letter to Katz interim CEO Brent Cagle, informing him of the federal investigation, Sean Duffy cited this statistic that assault rates on Katz vehicles are five times the national average for transit workers and three times the national average for riders. Ryan, if that is true, is this the first time we've heard these statistics?
It is for me, and Cagle actually just gave a presentation last week to City Council regarding cat safety, and was told he had told Edwin Peacock, who had asked for these crime stats, that he was still compiling them and needed time to compile them. FTA presented these stats. Now that jump that he cited has to do with one major assault in the previous year, 2024, and then five already that have apparently occurred on cats vehicles this year. So I mean, yeah, that is quite an alarming jump. We had another high profile, at least locally, assault on a veteran down near Pineville that was happened on a cat's bus. But yeah, that's my first time actually hearing those specific stats. They have not provided those publicly yet.
Eli?
And they have the CATS bus drivers and workers have been presenting safety concerns for a while. You might recall a couple years ago there was the bus driver who was shot and killed while driving. Then there was the incident where a bus driver and passenger shot each other during an altercation. There have been a couple other high-profile assaults. They've basically all taken place mostly on buses, not the rail. But this is something that the drivers have been saying for a while that they're concerned about
Right.
safety.
Ryan.
Just an interesting anecdote. Following the Ethan Rivera's killing, he was the bus operator who was shot through the window. They did bring the Viper team down, which is a federal task force of agents to help policing on the light rail, along with the contracted security who was there at the time. So this is not the first time that the federal government has gotten involved after a high-profile killing on a CATS vehicle.
So, in announcing this federal investigation into CATS safety protocols, Sean Duffy also criticized the mayor and the media. He said, quote, "Despite the media and the Charlotte mayor's best efforts to censor this tragedy, we have all seen the horrific images of Irina Zarutska's last moments," adding local leaders' soft-on-crime policies are directly responsible for her tragic death. That's a theme that is being hammered out by in GOP circles around the country. Mecklenburg County GOP Chair Kyle Kirby also blamed the mayor.
"Shame on Mayor Vi Lyles. You failed to offer anything other than platitudes and pandering instead of real, meaningful leadership."
The platitudes and pandering that he's referring to sound like things that we hear from every politician in the country after every single one of these incidents. She offered up thoughts and prayers to Zarutska's family, but she's been relatively silent, as have every city leader involved in all of this since this occurred. We offered her the opportunity to be on this program to talk about this on Wednesday, along with CATS interim CEO Brett Cagle and CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings. They all declined. At a time like this, is part of the job, Mary, of leadership, since you cover local government and you're the accountability reporter, is the job of leadership to be front and center. Is Kirby's criticism justified?
I think in times like these, especially when you have such a tragic incident compounded by all this national attention, people do look to elected leadership. You know, I think in some ways the response to this has been distorted a bit by all of the national attention. Local outlets were covering this from the get-go. It was discussed at the very first city council meeting, the first Monday following when the incident happened back on, I believe, August 22nd. That being said, you know, I think we've had multiple statements from Mayor Lyles at this point, but she has not accepted a lot of media interview requests. Malcolm Graham did hold a press conference this week. You also had a separate press conference featuring a lot of state and local Republican leadership. But yeah, I think there are definitely people who would like to see Mayor Lyles taking a little bit more of a direct approach to responding to this incident, as well as the national reaction in the last few days.
Eli, I know you want to comment on this, but I also am curious about your thoughts on this, because this is an election cycle. We just went through an election, which we'll talk about later in the program. Could she be being quiet? Could city leaders be being quiet because we're in this cycle?
Of course, that could be it. I also, you know, we'll talk about this a little more, but you saw Mayor Lyles' support drop from 85% in the last primary to 70% this time. It's a five-way race, still a, you know, super solid victory, but I think that might reflect some discontent. I think the city leaders have really left themselves open to that criticism from Kirby that you played. I think this is a pattern that Charlotte has developed of a really insular strategy. We have not heard from city manager Marcus Jones, who's actually the man where the buck stops. Vi Lyles waited days before issuing a statement that did not even mention the victims' names. I mean, if it were me and I was the crisis comms person, I'd say the next day, get the mayor and the city manager down there riding the light rail, doing interviews, talking about how they're going to increase police force. They've said they're going to increase patrols, but that took like, what, two and a half weeks? I mean, when you let a vacuum like that develop in the wake of a high-profile crisis, you are going to have people saying, where are our leaders? And I think they're justified in asking that.
Yeah, it seems that there was a lot of hunkering down, and then suddenly it gained traction nationally, and now everybody's trying to get on the train, no pun intended.
That's the problem. When you hope things blow over, they might, and Charlotte often hopes things blow over. Like, there was that shooting uptown where five people were shot, and it was days of media asking for more information before we got any. A lot of times they hope things blow over, but there's a risk that they won't, and they'll blow up in your face.
State Auditor Dave Bolek says that he will investigate overall security at CATS as well. And there have been incidents on CATS buses and on Lynx trains in the recent past. What do we know about the current, up to this moment, CATS safety protocols? Anyone?
So CATS gave a presentation... CATS gave a presentation last week, both to Charlotte City Council and the Metropolitan Transit Commission, sort of outlining safety initiatives that were already underway, as well as some responses to this fatal stabbing. They said they have increased law enforcement presence on tracks and stations. They also, and this is somewhat coincidental timing, for lack of a better word, have a new agreement that City Council will vote on later this month with CMPD that's going to make it easier for CATS security to police safety situations that aren't happening on a bus.
That's coming. And we'll talk about that. But I wanted to know what's in place, what was in place the night this occurred on August the 22nd. And some have made a point of saying that because, at least on the Lynx Blue Line, there are no turnstiles on the platforms. So you can get on the train without having to buy a ticket. And there's very few times that anybody on the train is asked to show their ticket. And there seems to be some suspicion that that might be resulting in less than normal security on public transit. I want to talk about that when we come back, because I'm not sure that holds water. But we'll find out what your opinion of all this is in a moment. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE in Hickory. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with on the local news roundup with Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News. James Farrell will chime in a little bit later on as we talk about education stories. He's our education reporter. Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. We were talking just before the break about the train stabbing going national here on the Lynx Blue Line. And I mentioned that some people have brought up the fact that we have lack security because there are no turnstiles on the platforms where you buy a ticket and then go through the turnstile, and no one checks the tickets pretty much on the Blue Line. And people are saying that might be dangerous. It really is just plain dumb in terms of revenue collection, but does it impact security? And I ask that because there are other transit systems around the country where you do have to go through turnstiles, where in fact there are people on the platform, law enforcement on the platform, and these incidents still happen.
Sure. I mean, we've seen terrible incidents in New York City where people are pushed in front of trains. I mean, that happened, seems to happen pretty regularly. And yes, there's a lot more security there. At the same time, in this particular incident, the suspect who's been charged, DeCarlos Brown, had not paid fare to ride the bus or the train, they said. So I think there's some supposition that if you were policing fares and this guy tried to get on and didn't have a fare, there's a chance he might have been denied boarding, and then the stabbing would not have happened.
CATS has taken some steps in the last few weeks, as Mary was alluding to a moment ago, to enhance security, and they claim to have doubled their security personnel over the last 2 years. They've also increased their security budget, Mary, from $5.8 million to nearly $18 million. Is there any way to know how effective this has been?
Yeah, so I think these are things that, you know, CATS has been moving towards for a couple of years now, since really Brent Cagle took over. He described it to reporters last week as sort of moving from a corporate security model to a transportation policing model, with the idea of improving safety. That being said, we have continued to see these incidents. And I think, you know, the topic you brought up of fare enforcement is one that's come up a lot. CATS has said that as part of their ongoing safety plans, they're going to be stepping up the presence of people on the light rail asking to check tickets. They want to get to a point where they have dedicated staff whose essentially only job is to ride along the train and ask people for their tickets. But Brent Cagle said it's unrealistic to move all of the light rail to it, what would be called a closed system, which is what we were describing, having to go through a turnstile or gate, because the system was designed as an open system, and that means a lot of the bus stations simply are not constructed in a way that would be conducive to introducing turnstiles or gates at every station.
So Charlotte City Council's Malcolm Graham has called on CMP to take over security on the light rail.
I think we ought to, within the next week or two, talk about how to be moving forward, patrol the CATS system. Again, I want CMPD officers doing that type of work, leading the way. And there's some other things I want to talk with my colleagues about. One council member can't do anything by themselves.
So it is true, I believe, that CMPD has increased security patrols at key transit points like Blue Line platforms, that the mayor says will, quote, allow CATS to fully execute the transit system policing plan. Is this a new plan, or are these merely new steps to enable them to fully execute what has already been in place?
I believe it's steps to fully execute the plan that they, the more recent plan. But I think a lot of people who aren't in the weeds of this stuff are surprised that CMPD is not the lead transit policing agency. There's a private company, PSS, and they have a contract. They have about, I believe, 185 transit security officers right now, which is around 30-ish short of their full staffing. It's a cost issue, too, though, because CMPD employs about 1,600 officers, and they've been struggling to recruit people and increase costs. So if you're talking about you want CMPD to take it all over, I mean, that's an eighth of their total number of officers or more. You're talking about.
Let me ask you about this private security plan that we are paying, evidently, to patrol CATS and Lynx. If they're understaffed, why are we paying them?
Well, that part of that contract that you mentioned going up from $5 million to $18 million, They are still in the process of trying to recruit and fill those 30 spots that Eli just referenced. So as of last Monday, they said that they're still on the way to filling that, but it is an active effort at the moment.
Ryan, how long has this been in place, this contract with this private company?
I believe it's been about 2 years.
Okay, so they're two years it's been in place. We've been paying them to do what they have to do, and they're understaffed. Why are we paying them?
Well, I think one reason is cost, like I mentioned. One reason to pay a private company instead of dedicating CMPD to it.
Yes, but when you pay for a service, Eli, you expect the service to be rendered. And if they're understaffed, they clearly can't. So why are we paying them?
You're asking the wrong guy. I don't know. I don't pay.
All right.
I will say one more thing on this subject. We had a reporter, Nick Della Canal, out yesterday talking to riders on the light rail, and he talked to several riders who said that even since patrols have been supposedly increased, they are still not seeing people actually on the trains. And these are daily riders who are not seeing any change in their day-to-day interactions or level of security. So there's a lot of questions about that still.
Ryan?
We'll also point out that the understaffing has almost been what's really come out of this, in my mind, in terms of people playing the blame game and pointing to different departments. And DA Spencer Merriweather says, my office is understaffed. Sheriff McFadden says the jail is understaffed. CMPD is understaffed. TSS is understaffed.
And we're getting
Mental
to all of that. We're getting to all of that. We're getting to all of that in a moment. But I want to hear from Mary. You're the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. This seems to be right up your alley here. Has anybody in government talked about this? If we're paying for services that cannot be rendered because they're understaffed, and I suppose you could throw the whole national treasury at this, and we would still have this problem because you can't stop every act of violence. But if we're paying for something we haven't been getting for 2 years, why don't we change companies?
So this is a relatively recent switch. I don't know the date off the top of my head, but CATS moved to PSS for all of its security is a relatively recent move. And as Eli and Ryan already mentioned, we've had this increase in budget over the last couple of years, specifically to fund these new positions. The messaging thus far from CATS in the city has been, we've already brought a lot of new people on board, and we've just got some more people to recruit, that it's an ongoing process. But I would imagine the questions you're asking will continue to be asked in the coming weeks, and we'll see if there's a sharper response from city leaders if things don't move quickly to fill those open positions.
So the alleged perpetrator in this incident has been locally charged with first-degree murder, but this week the U.S. Department of Justice brought one count of committing an act of causing death on a mass transit system, which is considered an act of terrorism. Attorney General Pam Bondi says the Department of Justice will, quote, seek the maximum penalty for this unforgivable act of violence, and the perpetrator will never see the light of day as a free man. Donald Trump has called for the death penalty. Of course, there is no federal death penalty at the moment. And in announcing the federal charges, Russ Ferguson, the U.S. attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, had this to say.
More than 150 people move here every day. We built a city that people want to live in, but we can lose that all if we allow violent crime like this to go on in our streets. And I'm here to tell you, the federal government is going to save our city from that.
Did I just see a red flag go up? When you consider the White House has already sent National Guard and federal troops into Washington with similar incursions into Los Angeles and now Chicago, is that foreshadowing?
It certainly could be. I mean, this has been used as a political football by folks on the right in a major way to justify whatever comes next. I guess I can speculate in what you just said. It could certainly be used to justify another excursion by the federal government into a city, because there's bigger legal problems when you go into a random city as opposed to Washington, D.C., where you have federal policing authority.
Because Trump has already used this murder as an opportunity to talk about making cities safe.
24 of the top 25 most dangerous cities in America are run by Democrat mayors, and it's time to stop this madness. The people of our country need to insist on protection, safety, law, and order. We'll do what has to be done, because we're going to make America safe again, and that includes our big cities. We're going to make those cities safe.
Just a correction here. It is true that 24 out of the top 25 most populous cities are run by Democratic mayors, a list that Charlotte is on, but we are not on the list of the 30 U.S. cities that have the highest number of crimes. Meanwhile, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker has said that if the Trump administration is really serious about reducing violent crime, they would release the hundreds of millions of dollars that they've halted that was supposed to go to police departments to hire more officers and provide more training. And if he's correct about that, is there money for something similar here in Charlotte or in North Carolina that is also being held up by the federal government at the moment?
I'm not aware of a federal law enforcement grant. I will say there's more talk of that at the state level. Democrats are using this as an opportunity to push Republicans on the budget, which the state budget has still not passed. And it's totally in Republican control what happens there. Sidney Batch, a Democratic leader in the General Assembly, said that she wants to see $110 million in mental health funding restored. That was cut in a previous budget a decade ago to, you know, help people who were, frankly, delusional, like it appears the suspect might have been. And Governor Cooper... Governor
Stein.
It's only been like a year. Governor Stein has said he wants the legislature to approve more funding for police and prosecutors.
Of course, Donald Trump has made reference to getting tough on crime in cities across the country, particularly democratically controlled cities across the country. But this suspect, as you bring up, has a history of mental illness. Our colleague at WSOC-TV, Hunter Sines, has reported that he was diagnosed with schizophrenia, that his parents had him committed. He could only be held for 14 days, and after which he was released back into their custody, but he became too much for them to handle, and so they took him to Roof Above, which is not equipped to handle people with mental health issues. So is getting tough on crime the solution here? Because so many of these mass shootings, so many of these arbitrary acts of violence are perpetrated by people who are dealing with mental health issues. So is getting tough the solution, or is increasing the availability of mental health treatment the more logical approach?
I think a lot of people would say there need to be elements of both, because as you said, he was committed, but they were only able to hold him for 14 days. So I think there needs to be an increase in resources available for people with mental health issues like this. But there also needs to be some ability to force people who might be unwilling to stay in treatment. Because you can have all the resources in the world, but if people are walking out after a short involuntary commitment period, it doesn't really solve the issue in more than a revolving door.
Yeah, and the Observer reports this morning, I believe, that the suspect made a phone call to his parents and told his mother, from the jail, told his mother he was all right, but that when he gets out, he needs to have some help because to get this piece of metal out of his head that was telling him what to do. That's clear evidence of mental illness. Mecklenburg County District Attorney Spencer Merriweather was on this program on Wednesday to talk about all of this, and I asked him to respond to Donald Trump's criticism about being soft on crime in these blue-controlled cities, and here is what he said.
My response is that in this office, that we have given special concentration in the way that we have proceeded against people who are repeat offenders and habitual felons, of using enhanced sentences to try to keep this community safe, and using the evidence that we have and partnering with law enforcement to make sure that we're holding people accountable. What it takes to have that happen is the strength of law. Where those enhancements exist, we use them. It takes evidence. Where that evidence exists, we use them. And we will use them to keep this community safe. But that does not absolve us of our responsibility to make sure that we are following the law. That does not absolve us of our responsibility to make sure that prosecutors are going into a court of law, making the arguments that the public expects from us. We will continue to do that. That is a responsibility that I've had as a prosecutor in this office for over 18 years, going on 19. And that's the very responsibility and obligation that I will hold going into this next year.
The other part of this problem, and this is something that Ryan, you alluded to a moment ago, and we faced it for a while in Mecklenburg County, is especially when it comes to repeat offenders being released back onto the streets, the lack of capacity to deal with offenders, both on the part of prosecutors and the courts. And Meriwether brought that up during our conversation on Wednesday.
We are the 14th, 15th largest city in America. You need more prosecutors, judges, police officers. If we are going to be the kind of city that has this kind of complexity, we are going to need more of everything, because certainly we have had to do without.
And Meriwether has been talking about this for years, complaining that his prosecutors must triage the cases they take because of understaffing.
Since 2010, this county has grown by 20%. We have a single prosecutor that's been added to the district attorney's office. Now, I will tell you, over the course of the last year, the General Assembly in both the House and the Senate decided that we needed at least 10 more. Now, they haven't come to an agreement yet on their budget, so that is not resulting in 10 more prosecutors for this office. But they understood the problem.
So the same is true of the courts. They've been complaining about this, too. They are understaffed. They are overburdened. And Republicans control the General Assembly. And now leaders there say they will introduce wide-ranging legislation this month, I believe on September 22nd, to require secured bonds for violent criminals and restart the death penalty after a 19-year pause. Ryan, how likely are these moves to pass? How likely are they to be signed into law by the governor if they pass?
I think with all the momentum that's happening right now, this is why they're acting now, and it's probably quite likely to pass. But you have to think about in the context of like this specific crime, what they're aiming to do is to make sure that anyone who has a violent crime history is then picked up for something nonviolent, then they're going to be continue to be locked up. So in this specific instance, the suspect here, DeCarlos Brown, was arrested in January, I believe it was, for misuse of 911. So then the idea would be, because he had a former prison sentence, 5 years for armed robbery, that he would have been kept incarcerated. This would be 9 months later that he'd still be in jail now for misuse of 911. It's just, when you start to think about the amount of folks who are picked up on small charges like that, who might have histories of incarceration and things, the capacity to deal with that just in the jails alone would be a lot.
And a report last year by WPTV also indicates that magistrates who make these decisions about who gets bail, who does not, et cetera, who gets out, who has to wait in jail, have few qualifications, little oversight, and more power than similar judicial officials in other states. And now they're reporting that a letter addressed to North Carolina Republican congressional delegation by Mecklenburg County Chief Judge, Court Judge Roy Wiggins, will be reviewing the local bond policy as a result of this stabbing. So stay tuned. We'll see what happens next. When we come back, I'll tell you what happens next. We're going to talk about education and get some good news, maybe, from James Farrell. Stay with us. It's Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at HabitatCharlotteRegion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eli Portillo, Senior Editor for WFAE News, the Local Government Accountability Reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Mary Ramsey, and Ryan Pitkin, co-founder of and editor of Queen City Nerve. Also with us, James Farrell, Education Reporter for WFAE News, who now moves center stage because we're going to talk about CMS and other things regarding education. North Carolina's Opportunity Scholarships, which give money that would have gone to public schools directly to students' families for the use of their education in private schools, are now in full swings. And now, CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill has expressed frustration with these scholarships.
I am very concerned that $1 billion of recurring taxpayer dollars going to private institutions that have zero requirements and accountability measures in place to receive those public dollars.
That reality has been discussed multiple times on this and other programs and in the pages of The Observer, etc. Is this the first time someone, James, in public education has talked about their misgivings about this double standard at play here?
I'm not sure in public education at large. I think we've heard other people in public education voice concern about the Opportunity Scholarship Program, but it's certainly the most forceful stance I've seen from Superintendent Hill, at least, at a board meeting. You know, typically she uses that point in the board meeting to kind of celebrate things that are going on in the district, but here she seemed like she really wanted to make this point about the Opportunity Scholarships, especially in light of the fact that there's still no state budget, which means that initiatives like teacher pay are kind of on pause. That struck me as interesting. That's probably the most forceful stance I've seen her take on this, at least at a board meeting.
Supporters of these Opportunity Scholarship vouchers say that this increases school choice, which it does. Opponents say that it gives money to parents who already are paying on their own for private educations and don't need the additional money, while not sufficiently funding the private school educations of those who can't afford to pay the freight on their own, and taking money at the same time from public schools, but not holding these private and mostly religious schools to the same level of accountability that the public schools are held at. Talk about that for a second.
I think that that's exactly the point that Superintendent Hill was making at this meeting, and there was a point where she kind of listed off all of the different regulations that public schools have to follow, things like building safety, making sure they hire a certain amount of certified teachers, open records and open meetings laws that they have to follow, and many others that she listed. And on the flip side, private schools, you know, don't have to follow those same kind of regulations as they're accessing this public money, which is her specific concern.
Yeah.
I think also it's worth noting that, you know, private school advocates would say, you know, that this is a situation where the money is following the child, not the school system, and that, you know, for parents who want a system like that, that doesn't have that same level of regulation, this potentially creates opportunities. Obviously, we've seen that up for debate in the world of public education, as some people argue, as you mentioned, that this just allows people who are already sending their kids to private schools to get this kind of money. But certainly, I think what she was trying to highlight here was that disparity in the regulations. And she actually made clear to say that she's in favor of parental choice, that this is not about parental choice. It's about public money going to a system that doesn't face the same level of regulation as what we see in public education.
So Crystal Hill's concern was expressed at the same time that CMS is celebrating what they position as historic academic gains on last year's state exams. That was discussed on this program last week, last Friday. But for those who may have missed that discussion, James, fill us in on that achievement.
Right. So where they saw really historic results was particularly in school performances. So this is when we look at schools and we see their letter grades and we see how each individual school performed. They saw a lot of growth in terms of how many schools came off of the state's low performing list, the number of schools that increased a letter grade. Those were all district records. And we also saw the school was ranked 10th overall in growth, which is the best ranking that the district has ever had. So that's really where they've seen a lot of celebration.
How do they explain that?
Well,
gains.
Yeah, so they've explained it through a lot of their kind of strategies that they've put in place in terms of things like trying to focus district-wide on students that are struggling. One of the points they made about the low-performing list, for instance, is that in the past, they've sort of targeted low-performing schools, but what they found is that they might be able to get some of those schools off the list by doing that, but then other schools end up on the list. So they've talked about how they've kind of taken a more district-wide approach to try to target students who are studying. They've really highlighted their use of data and trying to track student data. And then also CMS, and even in Union County, where they also saw great results, I talked to them a little bit about this, the investment of the state money into letters training for teachers in the science of reading, they've said have helped with reading scores.
Yeah,
as well.
Talk about Union County, because they took the top spot in these state test results. 70.7% of Union County school students scored at the grade level proficient level on state tests. It's the highest in the state. Why? What are they doing that we are not?
Yeah, well, Union County, you know, they would point to a lot of the same things that CMS is doing as well. I think sometimes it's also just Union County has high expectations for itself, not to say that CMS doesn't, but Union County regularly ranks in the top, and I think trying to maintain that is something that they take pride in. But otherwise, I think they would point to a lot of the same strategies. Again, I spoke to Andrew Houlihan last week, who also pointed to the science of reading investment as being helpful in reading scores as well.
Meanwhile, this week, national test scores came out, and they can only be described as abysmal and very, very troubling. What do they show?
Yeah, so these results on the National Assessment for Educational Progress, which is a nationally administered test administered by the Education Department, the National Center for Education Statistics, This was testing 8th grade science and 12th grade math and reading in particular. We saw this test on 4th and 8th grade reading, which also showed troubling declines. But on this test, we saw 8th grade science was down 4 percentage points. We saw the largest gap ever between high and low performing students in that. In 12th grade math, we saw it down 3 points, the largest percentage of students ever recorded in the test that were below the proficiency, the basic level of proficiency on the test. And then what I found to be most troubling was 12th grade reading was down 3 points. But looking more broadly at that, reading as a whole, 12th grade reading is actually down 10 points from 1992 when the test was first administered. And we've seen sort of this long trend of decline in that, which suggests, you know, we talk about pandemic learning loss and things like that. This suggests this is a trend that's been going on for a long time, even before COVID.
Is this national report card, are these scores just scoring public school students around the nation, or is it all schools around the nation?
So it is all schools. It includes private schools. They did not have enough private school participation this year to report out the private school data specifically, which this test was a little different than when we saw the 4th and 8th grade results come out. We were able to break those results state by state, district by district. There's a handful of districts that participate, including CMS, that you can get their specific results. But this one, they said it was just not in the calendar this year, not in the budget this year, to do the state-by-state breakdown. So we only have these national scores, but that does include private schools.
So Matthew Soldner is acting director of the National Center of Education Statistics, which released these results.
I will not speculate today about the potential causes of these trends, but I will share this concern with you. These results should galvanize all of us to take concerted, focused action to accelerate student learning.
He says that 45% of high school seniors fell below the National Assessment of Educational Progress basic test level, the largest percentage ever. He says, quote, to understand what this means practically, a 12th grader below that basic standard is unlikely to be able to use a 2x2 table to determine the probability of an event. I'm not sure I understand that, but this is something I do understand. The same student is unlikely to be able to use context to determine the meaning of an unknown word or phrase in a passage. How concerned should we be? How concerned are experts about this?
Well, one note of caution is to say that obviously the NAEP exam, it's described often as a low stakes test, right? If you're a senior, you're taking this test, this is not counting towards your graduation, it's not counting toward your grades. So there has been some question in the past as to how much buy-in you get from seniors who are taking this test. At the same time, they also take this test every year, and so you can monitor these trends every year. So when you see this decline, it is concerning, and experts really are concerned about what this means. When we talk about NAEP, NAEP is really just collecting data. So like Soldner said there, we're not talking about causes here. That's sort of the next step, is looking at, well, why is this happening? How can we address this? And there's certainly going to be a lot of attention focused on this, as there was when the results came out in the spring and we saw the 4th and 8th grade results being what they were.
If we have time, we'll come back to CMS in just a moment, but I want to go to the election that we held this week, the municipal election, which happened in the backdrop of everything we talked about in the first two segments with the stabbing on the light rail. But we had higher than anticipated and higher than normal turnout at this primary election, Eli. Was it because in part of what we've been talking about in the first two segments, or was there something else at play here?
Well, I think there are a few more competitive primary races than we have had in recent years. So I think that's part of it. There were some district races that were really close, and one in particular, District 5, where a lot of outside money was poured into to drum up support. So that's one thing. I do think all this attention on crime and national spotlight on Charlotte played into it, because that was right during the same window. And you also have to keep in mind that we're talking about really small numbers here. You know, we went from almost 5% to almost 8% turnout. So yes, that's all, you know, close to doubling. I don't know, 75% increase or something. But we're talking about a small, small percentage to start with.
And despite all the criticism that has been leveled over her response to the stabbing incident on the train, Mayor Vi Lyles won handily in the Democratic primary. Is she also likely to win in November against either Republican Terry Donovan or Libertarian Rob Yates?
Yes.
Okay. There were a couple of upsets in city council races. In District 5, J.D. Mazura Arias squeaked past incumbent Marjorie Molina by 37 votes.
I think our message resonated that this was a people-powered campaign rooted in love, honesty, and integrity, but most importantly, a deep love for East Charlotte that put people over profits.
It should be mentioned that Arias is the partner of WFAE's Julian Berger, who is not involved in any coverage of the District 5 race or that of Charlotte City Council. But Arias declared victory with only 37 vote margin. That's 50.31 to 49.61%. With several hundred provisional ballots waiting in the wings, Molina has asked for a recount. Is this race really over?
Well, there will be a recount and, canvass before it's certified. Those provisional ballots are citywide, so not all of them are in District 5, and also it's kind of not all of them will count. It's very uncommon for even a tight race to be overturned in a recount, very uncommon. So we'll see what happens, but Mazuera certainly feels good about it. Marjorie Molina is requesting a recount, and she has said that she is, she's said that the campaign against her is evil and racist, so she is certainly still fighting.
Okay, if this victory holds, this will be one of two races in which incumbents were deposed by voters. How do we explain what went on here? Because she's an incumbent. It's very rare for an incumbent to be overturned.
Well, she's got a opponent who campaigned really hard and also had the backing of the Service Employees International Union, which paid for multiple mailers and also 35 paid canvassers because they were upset at her for voting against studying higher pay for airport workers, contract workers. So there were a lot of resources in this district race. And, you know, keep in mind, 35 paid canvassers, each one of the candidates got almost around 3,000 votes. So you're talking more on Mazuera's side, more than one canvasser for every 100 votes, which is a crazy high ratio. So there were a lot of resources against her, which played a role in it.
The other upset took place in District 3, where incumbent Tijuana Brown lost to Joy Mayo. Brown is under federal indictment for charges that she says she is innocent of, but Joy Mayo received the endorsement of the Black Political Caucus. Which of those played the larger role in Mayo's victory?
I'd have to say it's likely the indictment. I mean, she was in headlines in a major way, and she held multiple town halls. She did not hide from it. She was outspoken in her refusal to not run for re-election. There were people at her town halls who were not even raising questions about it, so it seemed like maybe she could squeak by, but in the end, I just think that maybe the silent majority was actually paying a lot more attention to that than we thought, and Joy Mayo won that pretty handily.
So Edwin Peacock III currently holds the District 6 seat vacated by Tariq Bakari when he left for the Trump administration, but it appears that his seat could again be occupied by a Bakari, Krista Bakari, his wife. She defeated Sari Chakra in the Republican primary and will now face Democrat Kimberly Owens in November. Was this race about name recognition?
I think that was a big part of it. She campaigned and had a comparable presence to Chakra's, but so much more name recognition. Bakari has been in that seat, Tariq Bakari, since 2017. So especially among the Republican base, I mean, he's just a very, very known and pretty popular quantity. So that certainly helped in a low turnout race.
And Krista Bakari spoke with WFAE Steve Harrison after her victory. She dominated this contest with 75% of the vote. And she told Steve she was looking forward to November and would focus on public safety in light of the Blue Line incident.
We have to stop looking at our council and voting just Democrats in. We have to put Republican voices on that council to make sure there is accountability, transparency, and that we are putting public safety first.
Of course, she is a Republican, and if she wins in November, she will maintain Republican control of District 6. Ed Griggs will be another Republican on council, and Edward Peacock III is running in November for an at-large seat. I guess we'll leave it at that because we're out of time, but I do want to bring up the fact that Charlotte FC is facing its longest winning streak ever, and probably the league's longest winning streak. Ryan, we only have 30 seconds. What can you tell us? What's going on with that team?
We have a big match coming up against Miami at Bank of America, aka the Fortress, this Saturday. And yeah, if they get the ninth win in a row, that'll be the longest streak in league history. Coach Smith has to sit it out because he's suspended, but it should be a really raucous crowd coming in on Saturday.
And if we were to break that winning streak, take that title of the longest winning streak in MLS history, what would it mean for the team? Does it put us in some special position for playoffs, et cetera, quickly?
Right, yeah, we're in third place right now and looking very good going in, but we have to beat Miami with Lionel Messi to try to put us above the, you know, put us in a better spot.
So we end on some positive news. Ryan Pitkin with Queen City Nerve, Mary Ramsey with the Charlotte Observer, Eli Portillo and James Farrell with WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.